From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. More than 70 people spent a winter night outside a famous D.C. venue just to get a seat. You know the headliners had to be good. The place was the U.S. Supreme Court, and this week justices heard arguments on the rights of Guantanamo Bay detainees. A lawyer for the detainees says the U.S. is violating the law by holding them without any given reason. For more, we've got Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times, also Laura Washington, a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times, and Ernie Suggs, an urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Welcome, folks.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Marcus, the Supreme Court is basically hearing a case that says that if detainees claim they were locked up but weren't given a reason why, they can or can't bring this complaint to court. Give us a little background on this.
Well, you know, this is has been one of the most pressing issues since 9/11, and the larger question is what Americans are willing to do, what they're willing to circumvent. Are they willing to circumvent our Constitution, for instance, in order to fight what the president calls this global war on terror? And this is really goes to the heart of that argument. The president and his administration has argued for many one might call extrajudicial proceedings. They've argued that the executive branch should have the power to do whatever they want with regards to detainees and other terror suspects. And what we've had from the other side is civil libertarians saying we must have protections, they must have protections, like any prisoner who's in American custody. Otherwise, we lose our very soul in this fight.
Now, Laura, the U.S. Supreme Court has changed a lot since President Bush took office. How could that affect this kind of ruling?
Well, obviously, the court has shifted much more to the right and much more in a conservative slant, which would favor much more liberalism when it comes to the treatment of prisoners. The whole issue here, I think, largely revolves around the issue of torture, what the definition of torture is. And this is one of the kinds of things that the court is going to have to sort out. Some people would argue that by holding these prisoners at Guantanamo, there's over 300 still there, and only 80 of them have been prosecuted. By holding these folks for up to 6 years is in some ways a form of torture. One question is, how much information do you need to get, and does it take 6 years to get it? So again, these are the kinds of things the Supreme Court is going to have to sort out, and they're questions that I think this Supreme Court, I think, is not going to lean in favor of civil liberties.
Ernie, in a second, we're going to talk a little bit about the CIA admitting that it destroyed videotaped interrogations of two Al-Qaeda operatives. But before we get to that, in general, how has the media covered this story? It's a very complicated story that does, as Marcus said, have to do with the Constitution, with civil liberties. How has the media positioned this story, and perhaps has it been user-friendly enough for people to follow?
That's a good question, because I think we're all still kind of learning this as we go along. It's kind of a learning manual. But yeah, I think the media has done a good job of covering it. Whether or not we've done a good job of presenting the facts in a palatable way that everybody can understand, because as I said, I'm still trying to get my fingers around what the whole issue is of, you know, right of habeas corpus. And, you know, I don't know how it can take 6 years to interrogate someone and try to get new information. So I think that there's still a lot out there that we don't know, still a lot out there that we're learning. And it's going to be an ever-evolving media process, I believe.
Marcus, this term habeas corpus gets thrown around. Explain what it is for people who don't know.
Well, literally speaking, habeas corpus comes from Latin, and it means have the body. And it means that you must be able to have the evidence present in order to charge someone. And, of course, there's rules to how long you can hold a prisoner without charging them. And, of course, the administration has argued repeatedly that in these cases there should be no habeas corpus. We should be able to hold a terror suspect for as long as we want.
Let's move on to this question of the videotaped interrogations. The CIA says that it was protecting undercover officers on these tapes that it destroyed, and critics wonder if the footage actually showed harsh interrogations of the detainees, including the controversial simulated drowning technique known as waterboarding. One day after the New York Times informed the organization they were going to run a story on the matter, the CIA admitted it destroyed the tapes. What would have made this play different, Laura, from your standpoint? What could have revealed this information while there were still tapes, if anything?
Well, we don't know. I think that it's beyond any kind of rational belief that this is a coincidence in terms of the timing of the destruction of the tapes. And the reason to tape is one, to be able to document what really happened. And when you get into these discussions about torture and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, you have no way of documenting that if you don't have an independent record of it. And in this case, we don't have an independent record of it. I think it also, again, raises questions about what the government is hiding about its conduct. If it is indeed following and adhering to an international law and it is indeed not doing torture, then what has it got to hide?
And it also seems, if I can jump in, it just seems kind of strange that they would get rid of a tape that could contain evidence. I mean, what are these people saying? What are they asking these people? What kind of answers are they getting? Could that have been any kind of evidence?
Marcus, you're at the New York Times. How does an organization like that pursue a story like this and even get to the point where they can figure out that there's evidence that's been destroyed?
Well, that's a great question, Fry. And of course, at the Times, as in all journalist organizations, this is something we work very hard at, is getting information that we believe is in the public interest. And the Times in particular, of course, has been held up by the current administration as people who actually have hurt the cause of national security because we've revealed information. I think that's an unfair criticism, but I also think this is a great example of how sometimes, in doing our job as journalists, of course, we do go to each side in a story. We don't present a story without getting the side, in this case, of the CIA. And of course, it does raise the question, well, you know, in the name of balanced journalism and talking to each side, do we, in some ways, do a disservice? You know, we can't change our standards. They're high and they will remain high. But it certainly does open us up to the kind of things that the CIA, in this case, have carried out. And I think this is not the end of the story by far. You know, the Democrats are calling, and I can't imagine soon Republicans as well won't be calling for investigations into this and why it happened. The CIA, in this case, withheld information from the 9/11 Commission, from repeated congressional inquiries. This was not supposed to happen. And General Hayden, the CIA director's explanation that the tapes were destroyed in order to protect the CIA officers, rings very hollow because, as Human Rights Watch in Washington was saying this morning in the Times, the fact is there's lots of stuff in CIA archives that would, if it were leaked publicly, that would endanger officers. That is not the case here. That is not why it was destroyed.
Laura, I want to turn us to another ongoing debate on Capitol Hill, as well as throughout the country. It's over megachurches. Last month, the Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley sent letters out to 6 so-called megachurches, and the senator asked for more information on certain purchases and gifts. The question was, could some of these purchases violate the church's IRS tax-exempt status? The ministries were supposed to respond by this week, and out of the 6, only 2 did. Now, when we first covered this story, News and Notes was provided statements from all but one of the churches saying that they would cooperate with authorities. Now the ministries of Creflo Dollar and Bishop Eddie Long have not cooperated. They've written letters questioning the constitutionality of the probe. Other churches have asked for more time. Does this have legs? Are people going to, during the holiday season, which is a season when a lot of people tithe and a lot of people think of giving through churches, really want to dig into an issue like this?
I think not, but I think the bigger question is will it have political legs for Fry? And I think Charles Grassley, as you know, is a real tough-talking, long-time member of Congress. He's very well-respected. He's no nonsense. But there's a lot of questions that are being raised about the timing of this request and the fact that it is obviously very specific, very targeted. It's a handful of churches. And you can tell if you read the request that the details that you're asking for, it makes you wonder how much information he already has in hand that he's trying to test with them. He obviously thinks is up to something here. And because the fact that Grassley is a Republican, because we're in the midst of a presidential campaign, because these churches could be perceived as political entities, churches that may want to back, say, Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, for example, it raises questions that I don't think are going to go away throughout this investigation about why now.
Mark,
I think.
Oh, go ahead, Ed.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry about the legs part. I think that, you know, living here in Atlanta with Creflo Dollar and Bishop Eddie Long, I don't think this will have any kind of spiritual or legs in the sense that it's going to hurt either of them. Both of whom, obviously, we had a big front page story today. Both of whom refused to turn over any documents. I don't think it's going to have that big of a difference here because these guys, their churches are so big, they're so popular, and they have such strong congregations. And as Laura said, I think that the question is going to be whether or not it has political legs and whether or not Grassley is going to be able to carry this out in a political season and how it's going to impact him if it doesn't find anything.
Marcus, what about this question of tax law? A lot of this debate seems to have to do with what is the IRS's role in overseeing churches, and is the IRS only the only government entity that can oversee churches? Is Congress pretty much off limits in terms of overseeing churches?
Well, you know, it's an argument that the churches themselves have raised in the name of separation of church and state, that Congress doesn't have ability to ask them for these documents. Of course, Congress does have the ability because Congress oversees the IRS, and the churches actually have much more lenient reporting, financial reporting responsibilities than other nonprofits do. And of course, churches occupy a very kind of a sacred, but you could also say secularly sacred place in the U.S. tax code. And so what Congress is saying here is that as the body that oversees the IRS, because the IRS has to keep things confidential, does not share things with Congress unless Congress, you know, asks for them explicitly, or in this case, as Creflo Dollar's attorney is saying, who I should say is a former tax-exempt chief, the chief of all the tax-exempt stuff that the IRS did. That's his attorney in Washington. As he's saying, if the committee really wants this stuff, then they can subpoena it, which he thinks will keep it more confidential, or they can go through the IRS and demand an investigation through there.
Well, Marcus, Laura, and Ernie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Marcus Mabry is international business editor for the New York Times, and he joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Laura Washington is a Chicago Sun-Times columnist. She joined me from member station WLRN in Miami, Florida. And Ernie Suggs is an urban affairs reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.